Chapter 5. Kai and Athena descended the tower, making their way down the grav lifts towards the mess facilities near the base of the tower. They hadn't spoken since breaking their most recent connection to the Nuncio, and both were drained with the effort of maintaining a shared dream space. An appraisal of his improvement could wait until they had the distraction of a drink and the barrier of a table between them. The mess halls of the tower were iron-walled, stark and low-lit, reminding Kai of the serving facilities aboard a starship. He wondered if that was deliberate, given where most astropaths were destined to spend much of their lives. Solitary figures were scattered around the echoing chamber, lost in thought, trailing their fingers over an open book, or adding fresh interpretive symbols to their honora critica. They found a table and sat in silence for a moment.
"So, am I getting better?" asked Kai.
"You already know the answer to that," replied Athena. "You managed to send a message to an astropath in the Tower of Voices, and it almost drained you."
"Still, it's an improvement, yes?"
"Fishing for praise won't do you any good," said Athena. "I won't give it out for anything less than the full return of your abilities."
"You're a hard woman."
"I'm a realistic one," said Athena. "I know I can save you from the Hollow Mountain, but I need you to know it too. You have to be able to send messages off-world, to starships a sector over, and you need to send them accurately. You'll have a choir for the last part, but you know as well as I do that the best of us work alone. Are you ready for that?" "I don't think so."
Kai shifted uncomfortably in his seat, fully aware that Athena was right.
"I don't feel safe hurling my mind out too far," he said.
"I know, but you're no use to the Telepathica unless you will."
I want to, but... "You don't know..."
Athena leaned forward in her chair, the electromagnetics of its repulsor plates setting Kai's teeth on edge.
"I don't know what. That we take risks and brave horrors that even the most heroic army soldier or legionary wouldn't be able to comprehend. That every day we could be corrupted by the very powers that make us useful. That we are in the employ of an empire that would collapse without, yet fears us almost as much as the enemies at our frontiers. Oh, I am very much aware of that, Kai Zulane."
"I didn't mean..."
"I don't care what you meant," snapped Athena. "Look at me. I'm a freakish cripple that any Medicae worthy of the name would have let die the moment he laid eyes on me. But because I'm useful, I was kept alive."
Athena tapped her scarred palm on the metal of her chair.
"Not that this is any kind of life, but we all have our burdens to bear. I have mine and you have yours. I deal with mine, and it's time you dealt with yours."
"I'm trying," said Kai.
"No, you're not. You're hiding behind what happened to you. I've read the report of what happened on the Argo. I know it was terrible, but what good do you do by letting yourself get drained in the Hollow Mountain? You're better than that, Kai, and it's time you proved it."
Kai sat back and ran a hand over his scalp. He smiled and spread his hands out on the table.
"You know, that was almost like a compliment."
"It wasn't meant as one,"
replied Athena, but she returned his smile. The tight skin at her jawline stopped the right corner of her lip from moving, and the gesture was more like a grimace. A robed servitor brought them two mugs of vitamin-laced caffeine. He took a sip and sucked his cheeks in as the bitter flavour filled his mouth.
"Throne, I've forgotten how bad the caffeine here is. Not as strong as they make it on army ships, but pretty damn close."
Athena nodded in agreement and pushed away the mug in front of her.
"I don't drink it any more," she said.
"Why not? Aside from the fact it tastes like bilge water and you could repair blast damage on a starship's hull with it."
acquired a taste for fine caffeine aboard the Phoenician. Her quartermasters and galleymen were the very best. And when you've tasted the best, it's hard to go back.
The Phoenician? That sounds like an Emperor's Children warship.
It was.
Was?
It was destroyed fighting the Diasporex, said Athena. It took a lance hit amidships and broke in two.
Thrown? And you were aboard at the time?
Athena nodded.
The engine section was dragged into the heart of the Carolis star almost immediately. The forecastle took a little longer. A secondary blast took out the choir, and venting plasma coils flooded the ventral compartments in seconds. My guardians got me out of the choir chamber, but not before. Not many of us escaped.
I'm so sorry,
said Kai, with a measure of understanding.
I'm glad you got off, though.
I wasn't,
said Athena.
Not for a while, at least. I was living with a lifetime's worth of pain every day, until Mistress Sarashina and Master Ji Meng taught me tantric rituals to make it bearable.
Tantric?
You know how Ji Meng works,
said Athena neutrally. Kai considered that and said,
Maybe they could teach me.
I doubt it. You're not as broken as me.
No, said Kai bitterly. It feels like I am.
Your body is still in one piece,
pointed out Athena.
Your mind is still in one piece,
countered Kai. Athena gave a gargled chuckle.
In between us, we have a functioning astropath.
Kai nodded, and the silence between them was not uncomfortable, as though in sharing their hurts they had established a connection that had, until now, been missing.
Looks like we are both survivors,
said Kai.
This is surviving,
said Athena.
Throne help us, then.
At the heart of the web of towers within the City of Sight lay the conduit, the nexus of all intergalactic communication, carved by an army of blind servitors from the limestone of the mountains. These high-roofed chambers were filled by black-clad infocytes, plugged into brass keyboards and arranged in hundreds of serried ranks. Once each telepathic message had been received and interpreted, and sifted by the cryptosthesians, it was processed and passed on by the conduit to the intended recipient by more conventional means. Looping pneumotubes descended from the shadowed ceilings like plastic vines, wheezing and rattling as they sped information cylinders to and from the clattering, clicking keystrikes of the infocytes. Overseers in grey robes and featureless silver masks drifted through the ranks of nameless scribes on floating grav plates that disturbed the scattered sheets of discarded meme papers covering the floor. The smell of printer's ink, surgical disinfectant, and monotony filled the air, alongside a burnt electrical smell. Those of the administratum who had seen the conduit found the sight utterly soulless and monstrously depressing. Working as an administrator was bad enough, where faceless men and women were lone voices among millions, but at least there was a slim possibility that talent might lift a gifted individual from the stamping, filing, and sorting masses. This repetitive drudgery allowed for no such escape, and few administrators ever returned to the conduit, preferring to turn a blind eye to its harsh necessity. Veska Ordin drifted through the conduit on his repulsor plate, information scrolling down the inside of his silver mask as his eyes darted from infocyte to infocyte. As his eye glided over each station, a noospheric halo appeared over its operator with a host of symbols indicating the nature of the message being relayed. Some were interplanetary communications, others were ship logs or regularly scheduled checks, but most were concerned with the rebellion of Horus Lupercal. In all his 30 years of service in the conduit, Vesker had always prided himself on making no judgment on the messages he passed. He was simply one insignificant pathway among thousands through which the Emperor ruled the emerging Imperium. It did not become a messenger to get involved. He was too small in the grand scheme of things, just an infinitesimally tiny cog in an inconceivably vast machine. He had always been content in the certainty that the Emperor and his chosen lieutenants had a plan for the galaxy that was unfolding with geometric precision. The War Master's treachery had seen that certainty rocked to its foundations. Vesker saw the glaring red symbol that indicated a more urgent communication, and he flicked his haptically enabled gauntlets to bring a copy of the message up onto his visor. Another missive from Mars, where Loyalist forces were struggling to gain a foothold in the Tharsis Quadrangle after insurrection had all but destroyed the Red Planet's infrastructure. The Martian campaign was not going well. The Clade Masters had taken it upon themselves to insert numerous operatives in an attempt to decapitate the rebel leadership, but the killers were finding it next to impossible to penetrate the rigorous biofilters and veracifiers protecting the inner circles of the rebel Mechanicum Magi. This was yet another death notice, bound for one of the Clade temples. Calidus, this time. Vesker sighed, flicking the message back to the station. It seemed distasteful that the Imperium should rely on such shadow operatives. Was the threat of the War Master so great that it required such agents and dishonourable tactics? The fleets of the 7 legions dispatched to bring Horus Lupercal to heel were likely even now waging war on Istvan V, though confirmation of victory had yet to filter through from the various astropathic relays between Terra and the War Master's bolthole. The daily Vox announcements spoke of a crushing hammer blow that would smash the rebels asunder, of the War Master's treachery inevitably destroyed. Then why the use of assassins? Why the sudden rush of messages sent from the Whispering Tower to the fleets forming the second wave behind the Iron Hands, Salamanders, and Raven Guard? These were concerns that normally did not trouble Vesker, but the assurances being passed throughout the Imperium seemed just a little too strident and just a little too desperate to sound sincere. More and more messages, wreathed in high-level encryption, were being sent from Terra to the expeditionary fleets in order to determine their exact whereabouts and tasking orders. A veteran of the conduit, Vesker had begun to realise that the Imperium's masters were desperately trying to ascertain the location of all their forces and to whom they owed their loyalty. Had the War Master's treachery spread further than anyone suspected? Vesker floated over to a terminal as a request for confirmation icon shimmered to life over the terminal of an infosite. Despite each operative being hardwired to a terminal, the staff of the conduits were not lobe-cauterized servitors. They were capable of independent thought, though such things were frowned upon. A noospheric tag appeared over the head of the infosite.
Operative 38932, what is the nature of your query? Spit it out, Operative 38932, demanded Vesker. If this is important, then clarity and speed must be your watchwords.
Yes, sir, it's just that... It's so unbelievable.
Clarity and speed, Operative 38932,
Vesker reminded him. The infosite looked up at him, and Vesker saw the man was struggling to find the words to convey the nature of his request to him. Language was failing him, and whatever it was he had to ask was finding it impossible to force its way out of his mouth. Vesker sighed, making a mental note to assign Operative 38932 a month's retraining. His repulsor disc floated gently downwards, but before he could reprimand Operative 38932 for his lax communication discipline, another request for confirmation icon appeared over a terminal on the same row. 2 more winked to life on another row, followed by 3 more, then 12. In the space of a few seconds, 100 or more had flickered into existence.
"What in the world?"
said Vesca, rising up to look over the thousands of infocytes under his authority. Like the visual representation of a viral spread, white lights proliferated through the chamber with fearsome rapidity. The infocytes looked to their overseers, but Vesca had no idea what was going on. He floated down to Operative 38932's terminal and ripped the sheet of meme paper from his trembling fingers. He scanned the words printed there, each letter grainy and black from the smudged ink of the terminal. They didn't make sense. The words and letters somehow jumbled in the wrong order in a way that was surely a misinterpretation.
"No, no, no,"
said Vesca, shaking his head and relieved to have found the solution.
"It's a misinterpreted vision, that's all it is. The choirs have got this one wrong. Yes, it's the only possible explanation."
His own hands were shaking, and no matter how hard he tried to convince himself that this was simply a misinterpreted vision, he knew it was not. An incorrect vision might have triggered two or three requests for confirmation, but not thousands. With a sinking feeling in his gut that was like having the air sucked from his lungs, Vesco Ordin realized his infocytes were not requesting confirmation on the veracity of the message. They were hoping he would tell them it wasn't true. The meme paper slipped from his fingers, but the memory of what was printed there was forever etched on the neurons of his memory. Each line, a fresh horror, building on the last. Imperial counterstrike massacred on Istvan V. Vulcan and Korax missing. Ferus Manus dead. Night Lords, Iron Warriors, Alpha Legion and Word Bearers are with Horus Lupercal. High on the western flank of the mountain known as Cho Uyu, a graceful villa of harmonious proportions sits upon a grassy plateau. Sunlight reflects from its white walls and shimmers upon the red clay tiles of the roof. A thin line of smoke curls from a single chimney, and a number of custom-bred doves sit along the ridgeline of the roof. A thin, square tower rises from the northeastern corner of the villa, like a lonely watchtower on a great wall, or a lighthouse set to guide seafarers to safety. Within this tower, Yasu Nagasena stands before a wooden stretching frame, upon which is a rectangle of white silk held in place with silver pins. Cho Uyu is the old name for this mountain, words in a language that has long since been assimilated into a tongue that in turn has been outgrown and forgotten. The Migaos say it means the turquoise goddess, and though the poetry of that name appeals to Nagasena, he prefers the sound of the dead words. The tower overlooks the imperial palace and affords a spectacular view of the hollow mountain to the east. Nagasena does not look at the hollow mountain. It is an ugly thing, a necessary thing, but he never paints it, even when he paints the landscapes of the east. Nagasena dips his brush into a pot of blue dye and applies it lightly within the boundary lines he has previously applied to prevent the colour bleeding into the material. Painting in the freehand Mo Shui style, he lays depths of sky to the fabric and nods to himself as he watches the colour flow. He is tired. He has been painting since dawn, but he wants to finish this picture today. He feels he might never finish it if he does not do so today. His bones ache from standing so long. Nagasena knows he has seen too many winters to indulge in such foolishness, but he still climbs the 72 steps to the tower's uppermost chamber every day. "Well, are you coming in or not?" asked Nagasena without turning. "You are distracting me just standing there."
"Apologies, master,"
says Kartono, moving from the doorway to stand at his master's right shoulder.
"And to think some of the servants believe your hearing is going."
Nagasena snorts in amusement. It keeps them on their toes, and you would be amazed what insights you pick up when people think you cannot hear them. They stand in silence for some moments, Kartono intuitively recognizing it will be for Nagasena to decide when to speak. Kartono keeps his eyes averted from the painting, knowing that Nagasena detests people looking at incomplete works. One should only look upon art when it is complete, is one of his favourite sayings. Instead, Kartono stares over Nagasena's shoulder through the wide openings in the walls. Nagasena designed the chamber at the top of the tower specifically for painting, and the width of the world is laid before him. Shutters on each wall keep the wind out, and even when Nagasena does not paint, he often climbs the many steps to enjoy the views over the landscape when he needs a place of serenity. At present, the northern and easternmost shutters are thrown open, and the imperial palace is spread out in all its glory. Gilded roofs, jagged spires, and mighty towers jostle for space, and the vast city palace heaves with motion like a living thing. Supplicants, servants, soldiers, and scribes fill its vast districts with life and noise. Smoke rises from the cook fires of the petitioner's city, but the air is clearer than Nagasena remembers it. He tastes the fragrances brought to the palace on the wind like travellers from far-off lands. "What do you see?" asked Nagasena, pointing to the window.
"I see the palace," replies Kartono, "and it is a fine sight, robust and healthy, full of life."
"And beyond the city?"
"More mountains and a world rebuilt. The sky is clear, like a spring stream, and there are clouds, like the breath of giants around the peaks of Daulagiri."
"Describe the mountain," commands Nagasena.
"Why?"
"Just do it, please." Kartono shrugs and turns his gaze upon the mountain, its tall, rugged flank shining like silver in the sunlight.
"It gleams like a polished shield, rising from the landscape, and I think I can see the high peaks of the Gangkar Puensum behind it."
"You can see Gangkar Puensum?"
"Yes, I think so. Why?"
"It is a bad omen, my friend. The Migao legends say that when Pangu, the ancestor of their race, died, his head turned into Gangkar Puensum, and that it is the emperor of all mountains. The ancient Migao kings would climb its slopes to petition the gods and seek the blessings of heaven. So far, none have ever reached its summit, and the Migao say this is why they remain bonded as virtual slaves."
"Migao kings? The Migao have no kings or ancestors," points out Kartono. "They are a gene-forged race of labourer creatures. They have no past to have had any kings."
"That is as may be," answers Nagasena. "You know that, and I know that. But do the Migao, I wonder? Have they invented a fictitious history and mythical past to justify their place in the world? Does it make it easier to bear a life of servitude if you believe it is the will of the gods?"
"Is seeing the mountain a bad omen?" asks Kartono.
"So the Migao say."
"And since when do you consult omens?" asks Kartono. "Such things are for the simple-minded and the Migao."
"Perhaps," says Nagasena, "but I have painted the landscape to seek guidance."
"Painted the landscape? Is that some new form of prognostication introduced by the remembrances?" laughs Kartono. "I confess I have not heard of it."
"Do not be flippant, Kartono," snaps Nagasena. "I will not stand for it."
"Apologies, master," says Kartono, instantly contrite. "But I find the idea of divining omens through painting unusual, in these times.
That is because you do not paint, Kartono, points out Nagasena. The ancient artists believed a spark of the divine moved in every artist. They believed it was sometimes possible to discern a portion of heaven's scheme for mankind, if one had eyes to see it. Jin Nong, the great artist of Zhou, was said to have painted the greatest picture in the world, and when he looked upon what he had wrought, he saw the will of heaven and went mad, for such things are not for mortals to know. He burned the painting, forswore his previous life, and became a hermit in the mountains, where he dwelled alone with his secrets. Those who desired a quick and easy route to wisdom would seek him out and beg him to teach them what he knew, but Jin Nong would always send such fools away. Eventually, a band of unscrupulous men captured Jin Nong and tortured him in an attempt to prize the secrets of the divine from him. But Jin Nong told them nothing, and eventually his captors threw him from a cliff. "Not a happy story," says Kartono. "I hope you do not plan on following Jin Nong's footsteps." "I am talented, Kartono, but I am not that talented," says Nagasena. "Anyway, the story does not end there."
"No? So what happened next?"
"When Jin Nong's soul departed his body, the gods interceded and allowed the artist his choice of existence for his next life on Earth."
"He was reincarnated?"
"So the legends say," replies Nagasena.
"What did he choose to return as?"
"Some say he reincarnated as a pomegranate tree in the Lusheng Gardens, while others claim he came back as a cloud. Either way, he achieved the favour of heaven, which is something to be proud of."
"I suppose it would be," says Kartono. "So, do you see anything in your painting?"
"You tell me," answers Nagasena, stepping away from the stretcher frame. Kartono turns to look at the painting, and Nagasena watches his eyes roam the colours and lines rendered there. Nagasena knows he has talent as an artist, and the landscape beyond the shutters is rendered on the silk with uncommon skill. He is not seeking approbation, but confirmation of something that has been troubling him all day. "Speak," commands Nagasena, when Kartono does not say anything, "and be honest." Kartono nods and says,
"The tops of the palace buildings gather like conspirators, and the mountains tower over everything. They cast a cold shadow over the land. I thought the peaks shone like silver, but you have painted them in the white of mourning. The clouds hang low and brood like dissatisfied children amid the heavy sky. I do not like this picture."
"Why not?" asked Nagasena.
"I sense threat from it, as if something malevolent lurks in the warp and weft of the silk."
Kartono looks up from the picture, frowning as he sees nothing of its content in the world beyond the windows of the tower. The sun shines golden on the mountains, and lazy clouds drift like wandering minstrels across an invitingly open blue sky.
"You painted this today?" asks Kartono.
"I did," confirms Nagasena.
"I do not see what you see, Master."
"Nor would I expect you to. We all see with different eyes, and how we perceive the world around us is coloured by the landscape within our heart. You look on the world and see the optimism of a life spent away from hunting and killing. But I see..."
"What? What do you see?"
"I am an old man, Kartono, and my eyes grow dim," says Nagasena, suddenly reticent. "What do I know?"
"Tell me what you see," pleads Kartono.
Nagasena sighs and looks into the depths of the painting.
"I see
a time of darkness ahead for us. The world knows it, and it is afraid of the bloodshed to come. I fear we are about to walk into the lair of a sleeping dragon and awaken the most terrible danger imaginable. Cartono shakes his head.
You are speaking of Horus Lupercal. What have we to do with the rebel war master? His army will be ashes by now. Ferus Manus and the rest of Lord Dawn's strike force will be celebrating victory even as we speak.
I fear you are wrong, Cartono, says Nagasena.
I believe the war master is a more terrible threat than anyone can imagine, and I believe that Lord Dawn has gravely underestimated how far his reach has spread.
Nagasena puts down his brush and makes his way from the tower. He descends its 72 steps and enters his rose garden, wishing he could spend more time here, but knowing that such a desire is impossible. Cartono follows him, and they move through the delicately proportioned and harmoniously appointed chambers of the villa like ghosts.
"What are you planning?"
asks Cartono, as Nagasena enters his private chambers. Three walls are painted white, adorned with long silk hangings and ancient maps of long-vanished lands, while the other is covered with shelves laden with rolled-up scrolls and heavy textbooks. A narrow desk of dark walnut sits low in the centre of the room, and writing implements are arranged neatly on its polished surface.
"I am preparing," answers Nagasena cryptically,
running his hands over the one bare wall in the chamber in a series of complicated patterns.
"Preparing for what?"
The wall in front of Nagasena slides back to reveal a deep compartment filled with racked weapons and armour. Conversion generators, web guns, long rifles, energy blades, digital lasers, plasma pistols, cestus gauntlets, shot casters, fire lances, photon nets, and stasis grenades. Implements of pursuit and capture.
"For the hunt," says Nagasena. "Who are we hunting?"
asks Cartono, exasperation beginning to enter his voice. Nagasena smiles, but there is no warmth in it, for he knows the answer will only confound his friend further.
"I do not know yet," says Nagasena,